The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And in a potentially fatal blow for radio football phone-ins, Arsene Wenger decides to step down as Arsenal manager at the end of the season. We'll assess his impact, his future and the future of the club he leaves behind. In even more exciting news for Arsenal fans, Spurs commit themselves to the Spurs narrative by losing a semi-final they probably should have won, while Manchester United fans ready themselves to tell us we've been wrong all season. They play Chelsea in the FA Cup final, who beat Southampton 2-0. Elsewhere, we'll round up the Premier League, celebrate and commiserate the Football League winners and losers, plus Europe, including a huge last-minute bullet header in Italy. Your questions, feedback corner, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On today's panel, good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Good morning, Max.
It's nice to see you.
And always a pleasure.
Lars Sivertsen, how are you? Are you well?
I'm pretty good, yeah.
Excellent. Hi, Barney Ronay.
Hello.
You had to take the London Underground today to get here. How was it?
Okay, a lot of other people.
Okay. Was that an issue?
No, it's fine. But it's very interesting coming into King's Cross these days. You see a wide variety of people. I've already told you about the man with the black leather slip-on, silver buckled shoes, Slazenger sports socks and tiny satin sports shorts, I presume heading off to the art school.
On the tube in, I saw a man who on his mobile device was watching a show from a well-known streaming service that included some extraordinarily graphic nudity in a packed tube. And I would feel very awkward. I think I'd switch off. I mean, he could argue legitimately, like, this is from streaming service, the relevant streaming service. It's pretty legit. It's mainstream. But also watching graphic nudity on your phone on the tube, I think, is frowned upon in many cultures.
Well, eating stinky food or playing music out loud is also frowned upon. It doesn't stop people doing it.
What's worse, watching porn or someone eating a tuna baguette?
Tuna baguette I'd be prepared to let slide, but, a McDonald's or something I find just thoroughly objectionable.
Well, should we start then with the potentially the biggest news of the season? I mean, not necessarily the most surprising news of the season. Arsene Wenger announcing that he would leave Arsenal at the end of the season on Friday. A lot has been said, a lot has been written since then. Let's chat to Andrew Mangan from Arseblog. How are you, Andrew? Nice to talk to you.
I'm grand, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. You've had a few days to come to terms with the news. How are you feeling about it now?
It's still quite surreal and weirdly emotional. You know, I don't think anybody, well, certainly from my point of view, I thought it's the right decision, perhaps even one that's overdue a little bit. But when the news dropped on Friday, it was very much out of the blue. And it was quite interesting that all the frustration, a lot of the frustrations that you feel kind of melted away and were replaced by affection and sentimentality for a man who has done such a great job at Arsenal for many years and has given us all these amazing moments and amazing memories. So it's nice to see, you know, that this story is probably going to end with some goodwill, and hopefully if Arsenal can do the business in the Europa League, it'll be a real high. But it has been emotional and strange.
Have you been Wenger out for the last 2, 5, 10, 15 years?
I had concerns for a while, but I think where my mind was really made up was the season when Leicester won the title, when Arsenal couldn't bring the title back home to North London, when City were out of it and Liverpool were out of it, when Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea were all out of it. And I think that was when my mind was made up completely that if he couldn't win it that season, he wasn't going to do it again.
He kind of shot himself in the foot that season, Andrew, didn't he? Because that was the season he only signed Petr Cech during the summer.
Yeah, that's right. I think he will probably look back on that with some regret. That summer, you know, having added Mesut Ozil in 2013, Alexis Sanchez in 2014, bringing in Cech was, you know, you could see that was a good idea. But it was also about building the outfield squad as well. And it felt a little bit like we'd put the brakes on rather than making progress, and rather than adding another world-class player as we had done for the previous two summers, we put the brakes on and hoped that just those two guys and the players around them could do the business. And it turns out they couldn't. And I think if he could go back and change anything in recent history it would probably be to that summer and to be a bit more ambitious in the transfer market.
You've been a respectful Wenger out over the recent years. What is your opinion on those who are, shall we say, not quite as respectful?
I think you can make the point that managerial change is necessary, and you can have that opinion and express it respectfully. And I've got no problem with people being vociferous if they want to be vociferous. Where I could never really take it was all the abuse when people would call Arsene Wenger a fraud, for example. I just could never get my head around that. Like, you can want a new manager, but why be so dismissive of somebody who was brilliant at their job and maybe isn't so brilliant at their job anymore? The complete dismissal of everything that he did because you hold this opinion so fervently never sat right with me. And I think just anybody who resorts to abuse or name calling or a denigration of a man who has given a lot to the football club, whether he's done a good job or not, in your opinion, I can't get on board with that at all. And I think that speaks not just to football or Arsene Wenger. It's a societal thing, isn't it, that people have this idea that kind of abuse is okay, whether it's online or offline or anywhere else.
I don't know what you think, but there was a part of me that felt if Wenger had gone in 2015, when they were still in the top four, they won the FA Cup. That was the final where he took his shirt off, wasn't it? And they're pouring champagne over. It would have been a glorious ending. But there's almost, to me, something selfless in not doing what would have been a bit more similar to Alex Ferguson did, winning a final title, leaving a depleted squad. He hung in there. There's a theory that Wenger has been his own Moyes, in that he's overseen this slight collapse, and that there's now a realism around the club. People realise that the squad needs rebuilding, things need changing. In a way, that I feel there's something noble in him trying to hang on and not leaving on a personal high. Do you think he's been his own Moyes?
In some ways, you could make that point. Because I think it's you've got to find the balance between what would have been best for Arsene Wenger from his reputation and from that standpoint, and also his desire to continue in the job. You know, I don't think that he had any real desire not to be Arsenal manager, which isn't to say he's institutionalized or anything like that, but I think this is going to be a very big break for Arsene Wenger after 22 years. There were moments where he could have walked away. 2014 was the first FA Cup win, and he signed a new deal in the wake of that, won the FA Cup in 2015. 2017, when they beat Chelsea in the final, would have been an amazing moment for him to go. And I think Arsenal as a football club have to take some responsibility here as well. Now, we can talk about Wenger hanging on with his fingernails all you like, but ultimately the football club are the ones who can make decisions. The majority shareholder, the board, they could have made a decision. But what they've done for many years is not look beyond Arsene Wenger in any way. They've never even considered life without him. And I think even in 2017, Arsenal weren't in a position to appoint a new manager. They didn't have the structures in place to do it. And now they've appointed Sven Mislintat, who's the head of recruitment, and Raul Sanlehi, who's going to be the director of football, basically. Now that Arsene Wenger is going, he can be called director of football. That's going to be his job. So I think Arsenal have to take some share of the blame, if you want to call it that, because they've never put in place those structures. And if Wenger has been a little bit selfless and was convinced perhaps to stay on after 2017 for the good of the club, which might in some ways damage his reputation, maybe that's what happened. I think there's a balance between that and also Wenger's just desire to put things right and to work harder and to make things better at Arsenal. And I don't believe anybody could call into question how hard he's worked. It's the efficacy of his work that's been the problem, and the league table tells you how things have gone in that regard.
We're in quite an extraordinary situation now for Arsenal. It's been over 20 years since you had to consider a new manager. It's like you've debarked a ship in a strange land. You have to even consider this option of new people being in charge. As a fan, how do you feel being in this situation now, and what do you think is the way to go forward manager wise?
It's exciting, I guess, because it's new, it's different. We have an opportunity, I think, as a football club to move forward. there is an amazing football club there with great resources in the biggest city in Europe, you know, in the Premier League. It's an amazing job for somebody to come in and take. I think what people would like to see is somebody who can add a bit more structure and organization to the football. We know, and I'm sure Philippe Auclair has said this on this podcast a number of times, that Arsene Wenger is very much like a jazz musician. It's all a bit free form, and when it works, it's brilliant. But when it's 16 trumpets playing different tunes, it's not quite as much fun, you know? So I think that's why people are looking at somebody like Max Allegri to come in, who could add a bit more defensive organization and structure. He seems to be a firm favorite. And then there are the romantic options, aren't there, with Patrick Vieira coming back, or maybe Mikel Arteta, or even Thierry Henry being mentioned as potential candidates. But I think they've got to make a very solid appointment here. They can't be populist about this. They've got to make an appointment that in many ways heals the division that's there at this moment in time. It's one that will bring people together and make Arsenal fans think, yes, this is the right decision. But they've also got to bear in mind what the team needs. And it
a
does.
Lot of people would say Diego Simeone would be a perfect choice, and in part that's because, like you say, the idea of going for something different is so appealing. It's the kind of hair shirt idea that these players need to be whipped into shape. But there's a part of me that thinks going to a different extreme with a squad that's been assembled almost entirely by someone who has an entirely different approach could cause its own hilarious problems. I mean, what would happen Simeone walking into that dressing room now? I mean, you imagine the strange abrasive reaction he'd get.
I just would love the idea of Diego Simeone walking into the Arsenal boardroom and clashing heads with Ivan Gazidis and some of those people. I think that would be as amusing as anything else, which is why that will it'll never happen. They're not going to put themselves in that position. I think because of the power dynamic at Arsenal, where in many ways the chief executive has been subjugate to the manager, which in any normal football club, it's the other way around. They're not going to appoint somebody who is going to have that force of personality, I don't think, which doesn't mean they can't bring somebody in who's a good manager. But I think they'll want somebody who's going to fit into this new structure that they've got there with the director of football, with the head of recruitment, with Gazidis now perhaps putting himself forward as somebody who is a person of power at Arsenal Football Club. And in many ways, he's got to be stand up. He's got to stand up and be counted now, because for a long time, he's hidden in the background while things bad under Arsene Wenger, and he has now got to prove his mettle and prove his worth as chief executive. First job of that is going to be who they appoint, and after that it's going to be how he runs the club with this new manager. So it is going to be very interesting, that's for sure.
How was it yesterday? David Heitner writing in the paper today saying, you know, it's the start of the long goodbye, but the expected outpouring of emotion was pretty absent yesterday. What was your, how did you gauge it yesterday?
Well, I wasn't there. I was watching on the TV. I thought it might be a bit more full, to be honest. I thought it would be there'd be a bigger crowd. I think the game that will really be the one for the outpouring of emotion will be Burnley in a couple of weeks' time. That's going to be his final game at the Emirates Stadium, a stadium that he went a long way to building. And if we're still in Europe and if there's still a lot of goodwill going on in that regard, I think it'll be an emotional day at the Emirates, because for most people, even if you do want change or think change has been the right thing, there's a great deal of affection and admiration and respect for Arsene Wenger and for the work he's done. And it will be great, you know, for his final game to be an emotional one, I think.
And to seal sixth place as well.
Well, that's an important trophy, you know. We've gone from fourth place trophy to sixth place trophy. They all count. They all go in the cabinet.
Do you fear that he may come back with another side at some point in a European competition and beat Arsenal?
Maybe. Who knows? And if he does, fair play. I wouldn't really have any problem with that. I'd like to see him go somewhere. I don't think this is retirement for Arsene Wenger by any stretch of the imagination. I think he's too wedded to football and the day-to-day involvement with players and just the football itself to retire. I think he is going to get another job somewhere, whether it's with another European club or whether it's with the French national side. That could be an option for him. But you know, if we meet again in the Champions League and he does this over, well, that's his job, and fair play to him for it. I'd like to see him go somewhere and have success.
I like you said Champions League. Hopeful that it'll be in that competition. Quickly on the game, what did you make of it? Did you think 4-1 flattered you?
It did a bit, yeah, it did. It's been a little bit of a hallmark over the last couple of weeks where the scoreline has perhaps not been reflective of the performance. I don't think we could expect Arsene Wenger announcing his departure to immediately solve all of Arsenal's defensive problems. They were evident again yesterday at times, but you know, when you look at the strike power that's there, the goals that are in the team with Lacazette, with Aubameyang, it's such a pity he can't play in Europe. Ramsey, you know, there's a lot to like about what Arsenal have got going forward. But yeah, look, it was a win. I think it was a day that demanded a win, and it puts us in you know, prime position for that important showdown with Burnley.
Andrew, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Cheers, Andrew. Andrew Mangan there, founder of Arsblog. Midfield General says, what's your favourite Arsene Wenger moment? I think there is that. It's that picture, isn't it? The picture when he's just stood with his arms
at Old Trafford.
At Old Trafford. Yeah. It's a sort of classic. Lars, you sent a photo. You tweeted out a photo of you with Arsene Wenger where you're in some excellent knitwear. And can I say, it looks the saddest Arsene Wenger has ever been.
It might have been. It's not impossible that that was the saddest thing. I think it was at Reading away, because there's like Waitrose ads in the background that suggests Reading. No, because I, in a former life, I used to be like a TV reporter for Norwegian TV covering the Premier League. And we would always do a quick sort of, when we interviewed managers after a game, we'd do a quick bit to camera saying, well, we've lost again, and here we are with the losing manager, Arsene Wenger, or whatever. And we'd say this in Norwegian, and I think that's always the point where it hit home to these managers that this is now the seventh TV interview I'm doing, or whatever. This is a complete waste of my time. I'm here with this unshaven twerp from a strange country who have about five inhabitants, so there's really no point in me doing this. And I think that's what's going through his mind. It's well worth checking out. It's on my Twitter site, that.
So 3 Premier League titles, 7 FA Cups, 5 Community Shields, 3 Premier League Manager of the Season Awards, 2 LMA Manager of the Year Awards, 2 BBC Sports Personality Coach of the Year Awards, 14 Manager of the Months. I thought you might get more than that. The IFFHS Coach of the Decade, 20 St Totteringham Days, the Freedom of Islington, and an Officer of the British Empire. Did he change football, Barry?
He did, yeah. No, he changed football in the UK, certainly, because, I mean, a lot of our listeners probably aren't aware of life without him at Arsenal. And when he arrived, it was a very strange thing for a First Division club to have a foreign manager. You know, I think Villa did it with Joseph Venglos, and that went badly. There was a deep mistrust of this bespectacled, professorial type who arrived from a club in Japan some of us had heard of, because I think Gary Lineker used to play for them. And, you know, Tony Adams has famously said he thought, you know, who is this sort of nerd and what does he know about football? Sir Alex Ferguson was very dismissive of him. But, you know, he famously introduced broccoli and tried to get some of Arsenal's players to drink a little less and eat a little better. And I was just looking, actually, at the end of his first season in charge, the foreigners, well, not counting Scottish, Welsh, Irish, you know, in his squad were Nick Anelka, Dennis Bergkamp, who he inherited, Glenn Helder, Remy Gard, and Patrick Vieira, you know. And that was quite a lot of foreigners to have in a lot of exotica to have in an English squad at the time.
I think the global success of the Premier League is a lot to do with marketing. It's a lot to do with the fact that it's in the English language, so everyone can follow the storylines and all this. But I do think at the heart of it is this thing that you've taken these sort of traditional British football values, the intensity, the fight, the everything that people like about football in these shores. And you've put that in a blender, and you've also put in a lot of tactical ideas and a lot of expertise from foreign coaches, and you've put in the excellence of players from around the world. You've put all this in the blender and you've swirled it about, and out comes the Premier League. And that is why this league is brilliant and why so many people around the world love it. And Wenger was such a pioneer in turning it into that, obviously being the foreign coach, importing the knowledge, but also in starting to bring the stream of great players from abroad as well.
Lars is absolutely right. I mean, Wenger is utterly key in what the Premier League has become. And every person who enjoys it, every person working on the fringes of it like us, should be grateful to him, because he really helped that. It couldn't have been what it was if the best players were, you know, David Hurst and Lee Chapman. You know, it needed to become that kind of global thing that it is. And Wenger was really key to that. And that early period where Ferguson and Wenger had that fantastic rivalry, that was really seminal and really sort of made and cemented this as a place of these kind of theatrical, epic, soap opera, big managerial rivalries. And a lot of people who probably don't realise it should be incredibly grateful to his effort in that.
Roberta says, what are the odds chances that Wenger has a change of heart, decides to stay? Is it even possible? What would happen?
I don't think it's possible, because I think he's been let know in certain terms that he won't be invited to stay, even whether he wants to or not.
But it would be great, wouldn't it?
The frothing outrage would be quite amusing.
Craig says, now that Wenger's actually announced he's going to leave, is there another topic to replace the weekly debates of whether he should go? I think we should bring back the old debates for a month each, starting with why England played Scholes on the left. I'm looking forward to the can Gerrard and Lampard play together, and how would Rangers and Celtic get on in the Premier League debates month? They'll be good months for me.
He makes a very interesting point, because what always strikes me about those debates is how quickly they just disappeared. Like the idea that you had to have 4-4-2 in midfield. How could you fit these players in? That just sort of disappeared, as did the we don't have a proper left back, when people suddenly realised it didn't matter. You could play people on the other side. And I think the Wenger legacy thing will similarly just evaporate, and people look back and say, yeah, he was a pretty good manager, wasn't he? He did very well. And that will be that.
And that will be that. Let's move on to the FA Cup semi-finals. Manchester United 2, Spurs 1. James Fisher says, are you all gutted that United won? Barney?
No, not at all. Actually, I really enjoyed the game. I thought it was a really good Cup semi-final. I love seeing Wembley when it's not on England duty, when club football gets there and it's split in two with two colours. And it's a really good stadium compared to the kind of Cliff Richard concert it is on England Day. So that was, it was great, and it felt like a healthy competition. It was brilliant, and I thought Man United were really good and deserved to win. And that doesn't mean that Tottenham are awful and Pochettino's a fraud and all that kind of stuff. It just means a good team won a good game. I certainly feel a bit depressed by the idea that if people don't win trophies, we have to disdain their achievements. You know, Pochettino doing a fantastic job. But United were really good, and they played like a hard winning team, which is what they are.
But isn't that the point, that Spurs didn't play like a hard winning team, therefore forcing us down the narrative that they can't win semi-finals?
They've lost a bucket. Did they lose to a team they should have lost to, given their resources and what they've got? No, I don't think so. I'd say Man United, the dissatisfaction with Man United is justifiably that they were completely outplayed by Seville this season in the Champions League. Now, that's, I can understand that. That was resources not well used, and the fans would be right to sort of be disappointed and say, well, you know, what happened there? And Mourinho is deeply disappointed. Spurs, I mean, look at Spurs. Look how good their back four was last year. Three members of that have either gone or been completely unsettled by the fact that they're not paid high enough wages. I mean, Danny Rose jumped off a cliff at some point and became unhappy. Kyle Walker's gone. Toby's not playing. Spurs have fewer resources. They don't have players they can risk. They don't have a backup centre forward. They're achieving above their level. Dele Alli is a fantastic player, but he doesn't get a rest, and he's in his early 20s. So Man United should win that game and did narrowly win it. It doesn't mean that Pochettino is a loser.
I completely agree with every single word you just said, but I would add that in many of the other sort of big game Tottenham defeats, they've just been beaten by a very good team, and I guess they were this time as well. I was a little bit unsettled by their reaction to going one goal down, because they had half an hour left to do something, and at no point in that half an hour did it look like the players believed they could get it back. And as good as United are defensively, it's strange to me that Tottenham, the air seemed to go out of them completely, as I could see. And I think this sort of, they're bottlers narrative has always been nonsense. But I think this game was one of the ones where you look at it and you wonder a little bit about their mentality. And I think Pochettino hinted to that after the game as well.
I think the two things we just said are linked, though. For example, Harry Kane leads that team. I mean, when they play well, he can really torture like he did in the previous game centre-backs. But he's come back too soon. He doesn't look well. He doesn't look right. And that's because they need him so much. So he was unable to lead that team on the pitch in the way he might have done, partly because they need him so much they don't have a backup. And, you know, the two things are... But I agree, yeah, you never felt they were going to get back into it.
I don't think you can totally disregard the notion that they're serial bottlers, because there's a lot of evidence to suggest they are. You know, they've lost 8 consecutive semi-finals. That's a remarkable record. And there's a stat doing the rounds that they haven't lost from a winning position in any league game this season, but have been dumped out of 3 cups.
When you say they've lost those 8 semi-finals, how many of the players from this team were in the first of those 8?
Well, it's...
And how many of the coaching staff were there?
I don't know. I get the point you're making.
The answer is 0.
Yeah, but...
Maybe Spurs are a mid-ranking team who at that stage in competitions tend to come up against teams that are stronger than them. That would be, to me, a more sensible, logical analysis than there is a strange, abstract thing hovering over a piece of land, which is the only thing connecting those players to the players playing now.
So why then?
Which means they must lose semi... Like a witch's curse. Is that what you're suggesting?
No,
that's more sensible than the idea that, in fact, at that stage in the competition, you tend to meet stronger teams. The witch's curse will go...
So you're telling me Spurs shouldn't have it within themselves to be able to beat Manchester United?
That I'm any saying time they lost to a stronger
Spurs
team.
Manchester United should win.
They might have won, but it's not a surprise for them to lose.
I think it was a surprise for them to lose that game because they threw it away. I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me they threw it away with silly mistakes.
How did they throw it away?
Well, they gave away 2 very cheap goals, for a start.
But did you hear the thing I was saying about their defence? Do you think if their defence hadn't been unsettled by the fact there are players who want to leave and earn more money, that with those 3 other players who are actually better than the 3 players who are in it now, that those silly mistakes wouldn't have happened?
The 3 players who are in it now...
Or do you think the witch's curse made the players who are in that team say, I'm going to make a silly mistake? I mean, which one seems more logical?
The players that are there now, they are very good footballers.
But they're not as good as Kyle Walker, Toby and Danny Rose when he hadn't had his head turned. And that's a more likely
explanation
for mistakes.
You're making it sound like he had to pull 3 people out of the crowd and hand them shirts. They are very good footballers.
Paul Pogba and Alexis Sanchez are really top-level footballers, really good. Like if they manage to create a chance and then score with a brilliant finish against you, they've done something really good, which only perhaps really top-level defenders might be able to stop. I mean, that, to me, just seems more logical than the witch's curse.
Why, then?
But the witch's curse is your thing. You know, Moussa Dembele giving the ball away cheaply, you know, he shouldn't do that. He's a very good footballer.
Well, I mean, so's Paul Pogba. I mean, 2 things happened there where 2 very good footballers did 2 really good things, and the players who were against them couldn't stop them because those players did something really good. I mean, that's fairly...
Why then does every... Is it just easy and lazy for pundits and ex-pros to say there is a mentality? You hear a lot of players saying there is a mentality thing here.
Dean Ashton said it to us on the radio yesterday that it gets woven into the fabric of a club, but you would know better than...
Well, I don't want to interrupt your
former England international.
Ex-pros know everything kind of talk sport narrative.
I didn't say that.
I mean, far be it, footballers obviously... Well, ex-footballers have, you know, they've played the game, Barry. I mean, they know exactly what's going on.
Well, I think
any
they
kind
would
of analysis
have
that steps outside the analysis of a former English retired professional footballer, probably wrong.
No, but the point I was trying to make is almost every single one of them is saying there can be this mentality thing. Like,
well, Barney would obviously know more about the mentality of a dressing room fan than someone
who
spent a long part of their career in one.
What you're saying is that when people repeat a certain thing, it becomes true, or it becomes an accepted truism as around the club.
Yeah, maybe.
So maybe the same process is at work on people who are paid to give 30 seconds of their time to have an opinion. If people keep saying something, it becomes an accepted truism. And perhaps that does reinforce what happens. People keep hearing that there is a witch's curse, and maybe they keep believing it. But that doesn't mean there is some objective driving truth in that that goes beyond simple facts and the obvious fact that one team has more resources than another.
But I think there's the element of the self-fulfilling prophecy there. I think because the Spurs players know they've lost a bunch of semifinals and they know they've fell at the last hurdle a number of times. When Man United score that goal in the second half, you've got maybe not all 11, but you've got quite a few players on that pitch thinking, oh God, it's happening again, instead of thinking, all right, we've got half an hour to fix this. If Liverpool are in that situation, especially at home at Anfield, they know actually we've turned games at the last minute so many times here, we'll probably be able to do it. And I think that that drive and that knowing that we can actually do this versus knowing that we can probably do this because we've never been able to do it before, I think that is a factor. And I would say, as much as I admire what Spurs have done in the last couple of years, the fact is they can't afford to go out and sign Pogba. They can't afford to go out and sign Sanchez. They always have to sign players who are on the up, who are slightly younger, who can develop into top players. And that means they have a squad full of guys who don't have that sort of experience of winning things at the highest level.
That's exactly right. And it comes down to economics. Don't you think if Spurs had bought Sanchez and Pogba, it probably wouldn't be, oh no, I'm terrified of semi-finals. These are like hard-winning players who go out and win things, and it would have been the other way around. It does come back to economics.
Yeah, well, I suppose. But the frustration being, Spurs absolutely battered Manchester United at Wembley. I know it's different when the crowd is 50-50, but they in the league, they, I mean, I don't think they only won 2-0, but it could have been 5 or 6. I guess.
Well, so Mourinho changed his team after that game. They had a midfield two of Matic and Pogba, which got overrun by Spurs. Mourinho did a clever thing, changed his midfield, said we can't have that happening again. Pogba was very good on the left. So, I mean, that's in a way because Man United can afford to have Jose Mourinho in charge of them, who's a very good one-off match manager.
But to me, that's why you have to start thinking about the if not the witch's curse, then certainly the mentality issue, because they showed in the early portions of the game that in terms of a physical and technical footballing sense, they are good enough to outplay this Man United team. Yet when they go 2-1 down, heads drop like this, like there's no one on that field who thought they could do it. And that's completely irrational when half an hour earlier they were playing them off the park.
Well,
and
maybe I if think they had that's more where resources, they'd have the knowledge on the bench. There's no one.
Yeah.
All their best players are there.
But I think that's where the knowledge that we've failed at the last hurdle so many times has to be somewhere around at the back of their minds. The same way when England get into trouble in major tournaments, the players, I think it was Gary Neville who wrote this in a column, like when they're in trouble, they're immediately thinking a small part of their brains, not on the match, but on what the papers are going to, in what creative way the papers are going to savage them the next day.
But that's also
it's the legacy of failure. Kind
if
of,
they were better, they wouldn't be thinking about that.
Maybe, but
we know England aren't really good enough to go into the next stages.
No, I agree, but they're good enough to beat
when they
Iceland,
start losing and thinking that's part of the same thing of not being good enough footballers.
But it becomes a circular thing. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while. And I guess what Spurs could really do with is one or two players who have actually won stuff and are exempt from this sort of weird bubble that they're in.
So what breaks that self-fulfilling prophecy is having better players, being able to afford to buy Alexis Sanchez.
No, I completely agree with that.
Manchester United, as we've reported all season, have been really boring and useless, and Jose has been hopeless, and yet they may well win the FA Cup, Barry.
Yes, they may. I'm nearly afraid to speak now because every time I open my mouth, Barney gets cross and shouts me down. Would it constitute success for Manchester United? It's a trophy. It's good. Winning a trophy is always good.
I think it's completely fair to say United have had a decent season. If they do win the FA Cup, they will have won the FA Cup. And while they are miles behind City, so are everyone else. And there's no shame in being miles behind the City team. I don't particularly enjoy watching them play, I'll say that much. And I'm not convinced that what they're doing is in keeping with the tradition that they've been very proud of for a number of years and that the club has certainly not been shy in marketing themselves on the back of. But this is a new reality for Man United. I understand they're desperate for success because they've wobbled about a bit since Sir Alex left. And if they end the season having won the FA Cup, being the best of the rest in the league, and they'll be in a position where they will feel, okay, one or two more players and maybe a City that's less crazy good next season, and we can challenge for the league, and that's not a terrible place for them to be in. And whatever you think of Jose Mourinho and his appropriateness as Man United manager, that is progress. You have to say that. You can't say anything else.
They will play Chelsea in the final, who beat Southampton 2-0. I mean, we all expected Chelsea to win. what do we make of the Southampton goal that was disallowed? Matt Le Tissier was very upset again. The last time Southampton were, you know, in a big game in the League Cup, they were undone by poor decisions. It wasn't a foul, was it, Barney? Charlie Austin challenging for the ball with Willy Caballero. Caballero sort of caught it and fell back into the goal, and it should have been given.
I guess so. I mean, it's very sort of borderline, isn't it? It makes it, illustrates again how hard it is to make an objective call on these things, even though we're seeking to do that. I'd like to have seen it given as a goal, because it was a mistake as well as much as a foul.
I wouldn't mind if referees didn't blow up for those situations, but they do. I mean, Graham Poole said it, and I believe he's right. Every referee across the land would give a foul for that. Now, in principle, I don't think that should be a foul, but the way the laws are applied, it seems to be that that is a foul, and either all referees everywhere need to change their mind about this, or you have to give it as a foul when it happens in that one-off game, I think. You need to, you know.
Didn't Graham Poole said no one's allowed to touch the goalkeeper in the 6-yard box,
which
and
is
then
weird.
All the pundits went, hang on,
there's no law, but this is where I get confused, because the referees also receive certain directives as to how their laws should be applied, and to my knowledge they're not publicly available, so we can all look up the laws in the game and we will see there's no law that says you can't touch the goalkeeper after he's left the ground, but maybe there is a directive that's gone out that we don't know about.
It may be a simple sort of safety idea to discourage that, because, you know,
It's similar to when an attacker is closing down a defender and a defender goes down very, very easily and a free kick's given. You think that isn't a free kick, but if the ref plays on and the attacker is clean through, that's a bigger decision to let it go than to not let it go.
I was at the, it's interesting what Lars says, I was at the Millwall Fulham game, which was refereed by Andre Mariner, and there were endless free kicks given for tackles by Millwall that they've been doing in the Championship and League One, which are fouls in the Premier League. And no one in the ground could understand it, the players looked confused, but Mariner was simply refereeing to that standard, whereas there is a totally different culture in the leagues below where your force is considered a different thing. And possibly this is a similar idea to you and I. You think, well, that was just a mere nudge, but at that level it is given as a foul.
Yeah, personally I'd be completely happy with referees letting that one slide, but you'd also have to acknowledge that they tend not to. That, what did you make of the Millwall-Fulham game there, Barney? I mean, that's maybe one for Football League.
No,
Warner,
yeah, but we're here, we're talking about it.
Fulham were really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they were really good.
I watched that on TV. Millwall got off to a really good start and should have been, I thought, comfortably ahead in the first half, and then
really
absolutely got blown away at the start of the second half. It was strange, you know, but Fulham were hugely impressive.
Yeah.
And Millwall are like a good side.
Yeah, Fulham, they were really good. Ryan Sessegnon didn't have his best game. He was up against probably Mill's best player, Marlon Romeo, is very quick as well. But I could see Fulham surviving quite comfortably. There's loads of teams in the Championship who play that kind of tippy-tappy, would-be Barcelona-style football because the managers are ambitious and want to get jobs somewhere else. But Fulham actually did it really well.
Back to the Chelsea game. Olivier Giroud, that was a beautifully taken goal, Barry. We were trying to work out who's had the best in that centre-forward triangular swap, who did best, and everyone said actually Batshuayi was doing very well over in Germany. But Giroud seems to have been a canny purchase for Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, that goal was just remarkable. I was watching it repeatedly this morning on a super slow-mo GIF, and just the touches, the non-touches, and just leaving this trail of defenders behind him. He still hasn't shaken off the sort of super sub thing, though. And as you say, he still doesn't look quite right in a Chelsea shirt.
He doesn't look as attractive.
But I think he'd be a very good signing for them.
He's very good, Giroud, is he not? But I think at this point he's almost in what I once coined the phrase as the Lee Carsley syndrome, which is when a player goes underappreciated for a certain length of time, and then suddenly such a strong consensus is established that he's underrated that he suddenly, in effect, becomes slightly overrated. Mm-hmm. So that's the Lee Carsley syndrome right there. And I think Giroud is very much in that box for me now. I think he's everyone's favourite underrated player, which means he is rated.
I always think
highly
of him as well, like scoring, you know, really powerful, brilliant headers. I didn't think he had that in him.
I think he's a really good substitute. He's a really good backup centre forward. But if he had been at Arsenal those years playing behind someone, maybe of Aubameyang's class when he was really in his peak years, we'd think of him as just a wonderful, you know, like Solskjaer and Sheringham were at United in those years where they just had so much strength, and he would have been a brilliant adornment to a winning team.
And that's very hard to fit two forwards into a lineup these days because of tactics and things. But it would be great fun to see a full season of Giroud and Aubameyang up front together. I think that would, you know, hatfuls of goals.
Hard to do now.
Yes.
So who's going to win the FA Cup then, Barry?
The team with the best resources. Whoever has the most money. Get the accountants out. See who has the most money. They'll win.
Barney?
Well, I'll obviously have to check on the strength of the respective curses and if there's been any kind of juju going on or anything like that, or collective mentalities. There's a sheer mentality.
Why are you doing a Ray Parler voice?
Well, I'm trying to make it more understandable. I thought you would appreciate that. I think Man United will win it because they're just desperate and to win, and Conte's sort of off.
Yeah, completely. You can easily imagine United shutting that game completely down and Chelsea not finding an opening and Pogba whacking one in off someone's backside or something at some point. Yeah, I can imagine. I think a United win is in the offing.
That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll look at the Premier League. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. In Copenhagen on May the 10th, me, Barry, Barney and Jonathan Wilson will be on stage on the day of the Danish Cup final.
Please, Barney and I will be fighting to the death
about witches' curses and money. And you get to choose which team. You either get given, if you are on Barney's team, you get 100,000 kroner. And if you're on Barry's team, you get a witch's hat and a broomstick. So choose.
Fight against that. We've already established that.
Choose wisely. And then if they both survive, they'll both be on stage in London along with Jonathan Wilson on May the 22nd. Come and watch that one, please. PFA Player of the Year, Mo Salah. He's equaled the highest total goal scored in a 38-game season already, 31. The record is 34, but that was during a 42-game season. He could obviously still beat that. Barney, the right decision?
Well, there's nothing you can say that would sensibly claim that was the wrong decision, even though people will attempt to, because that's the nature of football. We like to have these binary oppositions, and no two things can be good or equivalent. But I suppose the one thing you'd say is, did Salah define the team of the season? No, Kevin De Bruyne did that. But on the other hand, Salah's been absolutely a joy and brilliant and clearly the outstanding individual. So if that's what the award is for, then he's obviously the right winner.
He has been so good, hasn't he, Barry?
Like Barney says, a joy to watch. I think it's the right decision. And if it had been given to Kevin De Bruyne, I'd also think it was the right decision.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have no objections. I suppose Kevin has every right to feel a little hard done by. He may not care. And if Jonathan Wilson was here, he would, of course, say that individual rewards have no place in football anyway. And he has a bit of a point as well. So, it's been a remarkable For his first season at Liverpool, I don't think anyone thought he would make any sort of impact like this. And he just seems to be the complete player. It's that some of the things he does are just jaw-dropping.
There's a story I love about him from when he was a youngster, where he'd played in an under-16s game in Cairo. And after the game, he was inconsolable. He was crying in the dressing room. He was just crushed. And the reason he was sad was because he'd been one-on-one with the goalkeeper five times and missed all five. Now, the coach, instead of scolding him, sort of patted them on the back and gave him some money because he was playing at left-back at the time. And the coach figured if he could dribble his way from left-back and go one-on-one with the goalkeeper five times, there was probably something there, even if he hadn't scored. And so he was moved out on right wing on the back of that. And what I really like about the Salah story and him scoring all these goals is that it shows it is possible to get better at things. You know, we tend to put footballers in boxes and say, oh, that guy can't pass, or this guy's got terrible positioning and he's not a finisher. Like Salah, when he was in Switzerland, was woeful at finishing chances. Like, it was a problem for Basel. His talent was obvious. His speed was incredible. But they had to put him on special finishing training, like with Alexander Frey, the sort of veteran striker at the time, had to show him where to put the ball. And to go from that in some years to becoming this extraordinary goal-scoring phenomenon, I think even professional footballers at that level can actually train and get better at things and improve things. And I'm a big fan of that.
When he only gets 25 goals next season, can we dismiss him and second season syndrome?
Well, it's an interesting point because obviously he's taken a lot of teams by surprise with quite how good he is, and he's gotten a massive role, and things will happen. People will try, will set out. Obviously that's been happening this season, and he's dealt with it very well, but there will be a slight shift. I mean, obviously we love to knock people down. That doesn't, whatever happens next season will not diminish in any way. Actually, Barry opened my eyes there with his comment that if De Bruyne had been given it, he would have thought, I actually think if De Bruyne had been given it, I would be thinking, no, actually, come on, look at what Salah has done. And I would feel a greater sense of injustice from that side of it. But I also agree with Lars about improving. I don't know if you heard the Jurgen Klopp interview where he talked about going and scouting Salah before they bought him. And he said, you know, we knew he was good. You know, we'd been on our radar for a long time. We knew he was a good player. But we went to see him. We went in and our reaction was, what the fuck? And he's a really good swearer, Klopp. I apologise for that. That'll probably have to be beeped out. But when he swears...
Because he was so good.
Because he was so good. Uh-huh. And it may have been a shock to lots of people how good he is this season, but I get the impression it wasn't a shock to Klopp, who was astonished by his progress in the years since he'd left Chelsea.
A word on Danny Ings, very good to see him score a goal. Had a lot of injury problems and was very pleased to score that. And for Darren Moore, good result at Old Trafford, good result at home. Potentially should be given the chance to get the job full time next season. We mentioned Kevin De Bruyne there. Is that the cleanest strike of a football this season? I mean, there have been a few. Aubameyang's for West Ham against Spurs, I seem to remember, just absolutely walloping him. But that goal from De Bruyne against Swansea, I mean, City were ridiculous, but it was just heavenly.
I really like that diagonal trajectory as well, the way he cuts straight through the ball and his standing left leg leaves the floor as the ball leaves the floor. It just looks beautiful. His balance in that moment was just perfect.
It's my favourite. I mean, I know we've discussed this before, but that is my favourite type of goal. There's just a purity to it that you wouldn't have with a beautiful run of Giroud, for example, at the weekend. Swansea are 4 points clear of the relegation zone. They still play Southampton and Stoke, who occupy the bottom three places. Stoke got a point against Burnley. Do we think it's done? I don't know. I was looking at the league thinking there could still be a twist and a turn in this.
I still think Swansea could go down. I mean, Stoke are really shooting themselves in the foot. Since Paul Lambert took over, they've lost 10 points from winning positions in 12 league games. And that's, a lot of those were very sloppily discarded as well. And that will probably ultimately cost them. But I thought they'd beat Burnley yesterday. They possibly should have. But again, they took a lead and lost it. But yeah, I mean, Huddersfield, I suppose, are safe. But yeah, I think Swansea could still possibly go.
And I think, like, Southampton, in the next three games, they got Bournemouth, Everton and Swansea. Like, stranger things have happened than Southampton getting 6 points from those three games. And then suddenly it's wide open down there. So I don't think it's a done deal at all.
There is a scenario that Swansea could play Stoke on the final day of the season. Winner stays up. That would be brilliant.
Well, we need something, don't we? We need something.
Well, and the week before Swansea play Southampton, it's all to play for.
It's all to play for in the best league in the world. And in the best league in the world, Watford drew 0-0 with Crystal Palace. Much discussion is from this game, or the only real discussion in this game, is Wilfried Zaha and his reputation for diving. He was on Goals on Sunday yesterday saying, it was a definite penalty. I was shocked when the ref told me it was a dive. What was funny was after the game, Mari Apa said, I'll be honest, Wilf, it was a pen. Making the point that now he has a reputation, much like Dele Alli, even if he gets kicked over in the box, it's still a dive. Lars.
So there's a chant in Norway that's a bit quaint. It's mainly sung by children at football games, which goes along the lines of out with the referee and in with the cow, or actually the cow. It's very specific.
Could we have the Norwegian?
Ut med dommeren, in med kua. And I would say in this particular situation, a cow might not have the cognitive, you know, wherewithal to identify a penalty, and certainly not the physical capacity to give the penalty. But a cow would also not have been able to give a yellow card. So you could say that some sort of bovine arbiter would, in this case, have actually done better than the referee, which is unfortunate.
Who was refereeing the Watford?
By a strange irony, it was actually a cow.
It was a Frisian, was it? Fair enough. Just running around with it. Look, I'm all for more animals on the pitch, frankly.
Yeah.
That's good for me, Lars.
Well, it's just because my girlfriend makes fun of me because so many Norwegian idioms are fish-related. And this one's cow-related.
That's nice to have
a few in your locker.
Isn't it?
It's like a pike in the reeds.
Most penalties won this season. Sterling has 6, Zaha 4, and Dominic Calvert-Lewin 4.
Well, I think it's all a bit unfair on Zaha. I feel very sympathetic towards him. The way he plays, he's likely to get bumped and tripped and to fall over. And even the slightest contact can send him over, just as it can stop him from getting to the ball in time. If you bump someone, you break the momentum. Imagine trying to defend against him. He's just brilliant. He's got a brilliant spring. He's very strong and fast. And to call him a diver because of the nature of his skills is, I think, unfair. I don't think he is.
I'd agree with that. I do think he was quite lucky not to get sent off, though, for that challenge on the goalkeeper. Went in, studs up. It was, I don't, you know, he claims he was trying to get the ball. He probably was, but that's beside the point. He could justifiably have been sent off.
Well, as Graham Pohl said on telly, you're not allowed to touch a goalkeeper in the 6-yard box, are you? So, definite red. Football League time, lots of admin here. Barry, you lost at home to Burton. Darren Bent returned to haunt you. What's next? Who's to blame?
Oh, everyone's to blame. I think the players are to blame, the chief executive is to blame. The owner is to blame. The former chief executive is to blame. Lots of players who aren't there anymore are to blame. Chris Coleman is partly to blame. I don't think he's done a very good job. He took it in. I can't understand why he took it in the first place. And it is an exceptionally difficult job to do because that club is a circus. But I think he should have possibly done more due diligence and then realised what a mess he was getting himself into and either not taken the job or made a better fist of it. But, League One next season. And
some new stadiums to look at.
Possibly League Two the season after.
Paul says Netflix have apparently been making a behind-the-scenes documentary
all season.
With the advent of Super HD, do you think we'll be able to pinpoint the exact moment that Chris Coleman's expression changes when he realises he's made the worst career decision of all time?
It's funny you say that. I was at Wembley with Jonathan Wilson at the precise moment Sunderland were relegated. And there was something very sad about that. There was a strange interlude where he was arguing against the maths, refused to accept, you know, Canute-like, ordering the relegation back, saying, no, it's not correct. Look, the maths is wrong.
Oh, he hadn't realised that Burton still have to play Bolton.
Yes, and he was arguing in vain. It was very, very, very sad. He had to be led to one side, sat down, it was explained.
They put one of those marathon foil things over him as he rocked back and forth.
I was a bit confused as well, and then I realised why.
Yeah, well, that is Burton face Bolton and another huge relegation decider next weekend. If they don't win that, they'll be relegated. Wolves, crowd champions after a 4-0 win at Bolton, who stay 2 points above third, but on Barnsley as they lost 2-1 at Leeds. Fulham beat Millwall 3-0 on Friday night at the Den. They stay third after Cardiff beat Nottingham Forest 2-1. Cardiff are 1 point clear with the game in hand. They play away at Reading tomorrow night. Aston Villa kept alive their slim hopes of automatic promotion with a 4-0 win at managerless Ipswich. There you go, Barry. Be careful what you wish for, Ipswich fans. 4-0 defeat every game for the rest of time. Now, fifth place Middlesbrough, now 3 points clear of Millwall. They beat Derby 2-1. Derby now a point and a place outside the top six on a terrible run. And Birmingham climbed within touching distance of safety with a vital 2-1 win against playoff-chasing Sheffield United. Bristol City 5, Hull 5. Hull twice fought back from 2 goals down to secure their championship status. They were 3-1 down and 4-2 down. Fraser Campbell put them 5-4 up in the 87th minute. Joe Bryan equalised in the 94th for City, whose playoff chances now look all but finished. League One, Wigan are promoted. There was a video of Will Griggs singing Will Griggs on Fire. A 4-0 win at Fleetwood Town means they return to the Championship after one season in the third tier. There you go, Barry. It can be done. You could bounce back. They're 3 points clear at the top of League One with 3 games to go. Second place Blackburn beat Peterborough 3-1 on Thursday night. They're 7 points clear of Shrewsbury. 3 games left at the bottom of relegation. 6 points between AFC Wimbledon and Oldham ended up in a 2-2 draw.
It's interesting that, isn't it? I'm not one to wish ill on anyone, but MK Dons, well, could well be going down and in a league lower than AFC Wimbledon. And I mean, a few people out there will find that amusing, not, obviously not me.
What about the kids, you know, who support MK Dons?
They do have a lot of young supporters. Mm, that's very much what that club's about.
Who've always supported them and have known nothing of the history.
Well, they're learning a valuable life lesson. This will stand them in good stead.
MK Dons have parted company with their manager, Dan McKeachy, after less than 3 months in charge. The 38-year-old replaced Robbie Nielsen in January, won only 3 of 16 games in his first managerial club job. His assistant, Keith Millen, will take charge for the last 3 games of the season. As you say, Barney, MK Dons in trouble. 23rd, 6 points from safety. League Two. Ilcino says, I hope there's a mention on the pod of Luton for Luton getting promoted today. 10 years ago, in administration without a first team, deducted 30 points before finally being relegated to the conference. The achievement of turning things around and getting into League One can't be underestimated. Well done, Luton. And there is their mention. They secured promotion after a 1-1 draw at Carlisle. They're 6 points behind Accrington and Stanley, who are top with 2 to play. Macclesfield will be playing League Two football next season. They beat Eastleigh 2-0 to secure the National League title. They lost their Football League place in 2012 and were among the favourites for relegation at the start of the season. They have the 5th lowest budget in the league under John Askey, proving, Barney, that it's not just resources that get you everything. And this is from Mark. One of my favourite football records has been broken today. Gainsborough Trinity, established 1873, relegated from the National North. The first time in their entire history that they've ever been promoted or relegated.
Wow.
I know, that's amazing. Imagine, you know, for the man who's been to every single game to suddenly have something.
There will be one.
Yeah, since 1873. And finally, a bit of football.
You know, after the Scottish Premier League split into top half, bottom half, and they fight out their various things, Celtic wanted to seal their title win with a home match against Rangers. And the powers that be in Scotland decided this would be a bad idea, so they gave Celtic a game against Hibs at Easter Road instead, and they were expected to wrap up the title, except Hibs have gone and ruined everything by beating them 2-1, which the good news for Celtic is that they can now win the title with a win against Rangers at Celtic Park next weekend. So that should be fun if they do it. And yeah, Neil Lennon has done a very good job at Hibs, actually. They got promoted last season. They can still come second. And he is being talked about as a possibly getting his old job back at Celtic if Brendan Rodgers goes elsewhere this summer, which seems to be a possibility.
May I bring you your attention to the 2014 Neil Lennon calendar? It is very much worth Googling. It's a thing of absolute beauty. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin in Italy. A huge win for Napoli against Juventus. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go to Italy and discuss a huge win for Napoli at Juve with Paolo Bandini. How are you, Paolo?
I'm a little tired from flying back from Italy last night, unfortunately not from Turin, but I'm good otherwise.
What a header that was.
That was incredible, wasn't it? Yeah, and it sort of echoes, I think, in quite how much airtime Koulibaly got, echoes of the Cristiano Ronaldo goal against Juventus, which of course seemed to break their spirits in the first leg of that Champions League tie, although to get a bit more lively. But look, it was a really, in some ways, it felt like a particularly poetic moment for me, because this Napoli team has been famous for the past two seasons and more for the trio of what one journalist referred to, and I have stolen and kept referring to, as the marvellous Smurfs up front for Napoli. Those three diminutive strikers, kind of Callejon, Mertens and Lorenzo Insigne, and their ability to play the ball on the floor, the ability to play sort of silky football. I think in some ways it was sort of fitting that actually the way they finally overcame Juventus, and it really was a huge moment. I mean, they've lost all six times in the past they've come to play away in Turin at the Allianz Stadium, the new stadium that not so new anymore, I suppose, but this is the stadium that Juventus have been playing in since 2011. And that they finally broke that hex with a goal from the one giant in the team with a towering header felt somehow apt to me.
Yeah, and I don't know, there's just nothing better than to do it in the 90th minute as well.
Yeah, and look, deservedly, Napoli weren't great in this game. It wasn't the sort of purely footballing level, a technically brilliant game, but Napoli tried to win. Napoli played almost in the embodiment of that header. They played hard. They played with a sort of fierce commitment to getting three players most of the time on Juventus' ball carriers, always sort of trying to close down the angles. And they made chances. You know, they weren't always pretty, but they carved out chances. Juventus were timid. Juventus seemed to have this idea in mind of protecting themselves, knowing that a draw, which would have kept them 4 points clear at the top, was enough, whereas instead they wound up allowing Napoli to come onto them. They wound up not having a single shot on target in the entire game, Juventus, which hasn't happened to them again the entire time they've been playing in that stadium. So since 2011, they haven't had a single game before now without a shot on target. And that's how the game was. And as you say, to sum it all up in the physicality of that moment felt appropriate.
Paolo, I know it's not quite comparable to Leicester winning the title, but is everyone sort of rooting for Napoli in Italy, apart from Juve fans, obviously?
I mean, I suppose you can never say everyone, but there's certainly a lot of people rooting for them, yeah. I mean, it's a slightly interesting thing with Naples and with Napoli is that they don't have a natural rival in quite the same way as some others do. In the past, there's sort of some rivalry with Roma, some rivalry with the teams in Sicily, but there's not a team right there in that part of Italy, in Campania, to compete with Naples for that fan base. So they have a very united support in Naples, which was going off last night, of course. I know 10,000 fans showed up just to meet the plane when it landed back in the city at the airport, which is ridiculous, by the way. And you know, the bus didn't manage to leave, having landed at 1:30. They didn't manage to even get the team bus out of that until 4 in the morning. So the local support is, of course, wild. But yeah, look, after 6 years of Juventus winning the title, a lot of people in Italy are itching for a change. And there's always been this feeling around Juventus in Italy. You're either with them, which a lot of people are. They're nationally the best-supported team still. But if you're not with them, generally, very often, you're against them. So, yeah, a lot of Italy is reveling in the idea they could lose it. We should say here, by the way, because it's easy to forget this in the moment, Juventus are still top. Juventus are still 1 point clear at the top of Serie A. It's just that it looks a lot more daunting for them now because they still have to go away to Inter and away to Roma, both of whom, of course, locked into a really, really tight battle for the Champions League places right now. Napoli have got some tough games. Their next one is away to Fiorentina. They've got to go away to Sampdoria, who have been good at the Marassi. But it certainly, at this moment in time, feels like the momentum is with Napoli and that fixture list maybe just tips things in their balance, in their favour.
So you think they're going to win it?
I don't want to jinx anything for anybody here, Max. I'm certain if I say anything that Napoli fans are going to come after me for saying it. But last night felt like one of those moments, you know, and hey, maybe there's another moment coming that we haven't prepared ourselves for, but last night felt like something. It felt like something was happening.
But you know that if they don't win it, those videos of the fireworks going off and else will be played back in their faces, won't they? Easy 3-0 win for Roma over Spurs as they warm up for the Champions League. What's the Italian view on Roma's trip to Anfield?
It was a really, I thought, impressive win for Roma, actually, because they are in this impossible situation almost where they are playing for one of the biggest ties that, you know, has happened in club history. I mean, it's in the second European Cup semi-final they've ever been to and the first in more than three decades. And of course, they want to pour all of their energy into that. They want to make that the biggest priority. But equally, they are not guaranteed of getting back into the Champions League next season. Them, Lazio and Inter currently all within a point of each other with only two spaces for the three of them. So they can't afford to let up in the league. And Di Francesco did take some gambles with his team selection this weekend. You could see him putting the priority on the Liverpool game, which is, I suppose, on an emotional level, as someone who wants to see the Champions League games be these absolute pinnacle of European football, it's nice to see, but it was a risk. He didn't start Edin Dzeko, which meant he started Patrick Schick up front. Patrick Schick, up to this point, had not scored a single goal in Serie A. They signed him to some acclaim last summer, but he was 17 games without a goal. Well, this weekend he broke his duck. They managed to get that out of him at last, and they also rested players in midfield, rested players in defence all through the team, and they came up with a really big performance, because Spal, despite being down the bottom of the table, were unbeaten in, I can't remember exactly, it's either 7 or 8 games. So it was a really mature, impressive performance from Roma, and perhaps most crucially of all, a performance that allowed them to rest Edin Dzeko, to rest Daniele Rossi, Alessandro Florenzi. All of them didn't play. Guys like Chengizunda, who I imagine will have a big part to play against Liverpool, did come on, but only off the bench. Same for Diego Perotti. It was a really, really big result for Roma, I thought, this weekend.
And a word for everyone's favourite Italian team, Benevento. They won at the San Siro, but still got relegated.
Yeah, I mean, what a sort of bizarre footnote this is on Benevento season, that they have got relegated and yet they are undefeated in 2 games against Milan. Drew 2 all of them at home, beat them 1-0 away from home. The first of those games, of course, was the one that famously ended with the goalkeeper Alberto Brignoli coming up and scoring. So it's been a fun ride for Benevento in the top flight, but perhaps not... Perhaps not the ending they were hoping for, but I suppose if you were hoping for something to console you going back down, then beating Milan isn't bad.
Paolo, thanks for your time.
No problem, anytime.
Paolo Bandini there, our Italian expert. To Spain now, Barcelona hammered Sevilla 5-0 in the Copa del Rey, Lars. Did you enjoy this masterclass?
I mean, I did, and fittingly it was... very much an Andres Iniesta masterclass. I think it was one of the games where all of his extraordinary qualities were on display, and given that it's one of the last games he'll play for Barcelona, that felt apt and appropriate.
Adam says, given the Iniesta masterclass, do the panel think he should have held out for 3 million bottles of wine? and are we ready to admit that Sevilla aren't very good?
Sevilla are strange, because they've been... All season they've had this thing of, in some games they look very decent and in other games they just look terrible. And I watch quite a bit of Spanish football, but not as much as some, and I don't have any good working theories as to why that is the case. I will say about Iniesta, there's a part of me that quite likes seeing a player go out on a high like this. You know, you can make a case that he's still good enough to play a role at Barcelona. I mean, if he wanted to, I'm sure they would have given him another contract and he could have played 10-15 games next season and helped them out here and there. There's something quite majestic about a player just seeing, all right, yeah, I'm still at my peak now and I want to leave it there. I quite like that.
But he's not going out on a high, he's going to China on a high, isn't it? So if he'd said, yeah, I'm never playing football again, is
no,
that
that's
more
true.
Glorious?
That is true. And the Chinese Super League can be interesting to watch. I do watch some of it sometimes when there's time. There isn't always.
I mean, he is going to become renowned as one of those one club men who played for more than one club. You know, John Terry, Steven Gerrard, and
I think going to China is more interesting than going to Qatar. Anyway, hello, Xavi. But it'll be fascinating because he'll have to get used to playing with quite a few teammates of, shall we say, an inferior quality. So for a guy whose stock in trade is passing the ball beautifully around, I think he will become frustrated perhaps at what's going on around him. Someone like Hulk is more a natural fit for China, because he'll just whack it towards goal wherever he is. And with some of the goalkeepers in the Chinese league being of questionable quality, that is very often quite a fruitful strategy.
You're saying Hulk only has the shoot button? He's one of those,
yeah, basically,
those players, like Jermaine Defoe. The real hero, you know, in terms of how to... you know, end your career, is Luke Chadwick, who, as a Cambridge United fan, took a pay cut just so he could play. And then when he scored for Cambridge United, he said it was better than playing in the Champions League for Manchester United. There's a hero. Interesting moment when Coutinho scored, but the whistle had been blown for a penalty in the final. before the ball crossed the line. So they let Coutinho take the penalty, even though Suarez was on a hat-trick. And a lovely moment in the middle of the game where Iniesta was booked for dissent, fumed for a minute, and then came to apologise to the referee for losing his head. What a wonderful man he is.
I'm enjoying this a little tidbit in Sid Lowe's piece from the final, pointing out that Suarez has played in 5 finals for Barcelona and scored in all 5 of them. So maybe Tottenham should get him, I guess. Semi-final record. Yeah, that's what we've got to find out.
In La Liga, Atletico Madrid shared a goalless draw with Real Betis, leaving Barcelona needing only 2 points from their final 5 games to win the title. Valencia missed the chance to go level on points with Real Madrid, who didn't play. They could only draw 1-1 with Celta Vigo. Talking of Real, they play Bayern Munich on Wednesday in the Champions League. Hey, Barney, who's going to win that one?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, generally this is why, I guess, why we play the games, because it's so hard to predict. But Real Madrid are a really confusing team, aren't they? I mean, you'd never bet against Ronaldo because he's a winning robot. And they do have a lot of more energy in the team than they did in the last couple of European ties. But on the other hand, it just feels wrong that they could possibly win this 3 times in a row. I think Real Madrid, though.
I find it very hard to gauge this Bayern team because they've been so dominant in their domestic league and they've had quite a favourable draw in the Champions League. So they haven't really been tested. So they have looked magnificent throughout the season, pretty much. But having watched a lot of their Bundesliga games, they've also been fantastically sloppy on occasion. You do wonder if the fact that Real Madrid have gone through a bit of a difficult time, that they've had to overcome the sort of wobble against Juventus, that they had quite a tricky group in the Champions League, maybe they're a bit more battle-hardened this season. You know, they've had to dig deep a little bit and they know that it's this or nothing. Whereas maybe Bayern don't quite have that. So I just, if I had to put money on something, which I absolutely won't be doing, I think Real Madrid to progress, perhaps.
Okay. Obviously, we'll round that up on Thursday. Bayern warmed up for that game with a 3-0 win at Hanover. Elsewhere, English youngster Jadon Sancho shone as Dortmund beat Leverkusen 4-0 in the Bundesliga. He's become the youngest Englishman to score in the German top flight, the first ever to net for Dortmund, aged 18 years and 27 days. Also got 2 assists.
It's fantastic to see young English players doing that, and even more fantastic to see them doing it just as we've voted for a political change that will stop them from being able to do this in the future. But generally, English people should go abroad, should travel, should find work elsewhere. He's a great role model.
I'd be curious to know who the previous youngest was. It was probably Alan McInally or something, was it?
Not the youngest Englishman.
Oh, God, of course, sure. Yeah. Sorry, Al.
According to producer Jonathan, the next youngest is Adamola Lookman. So there we are. It's not Kevin Keegan, who must be... He's in the list, though, Barney.
He's up there. Yeah.
He's up there. Alan McInally, not in the English list. Well, that's okay.
Speaking of Lookman, can we flag up Hoffenheim beating RB Leipzig 5-2? Monster result there, if you will. But that actually brings Hoffenheim to within 2 points of a Champions League spot, which, given that they lost their best defender and best midfielder after their great season last year, is a pretty incredible achievement by them and their young manager, Julian Nagelsmann, who, for a man who has yet to hit puberty, is doing very well for himself.
Spurs fans will be excited to hear that Lewis Holtby kept alive Hamburg's hopes of survival by beating their fellow relegation candidates Freiburg 1-0. In France, Lyon went to within a point of Monaco in the second automatic qualification spot for the Champions League. Monaco are on 70 points. Lyon and Marseille are on 69. Only 2 spots available between the 3 of them. Yaya Sanogo has 3 goals in his last 4 games. Finally coming into a bit of form, his Toulouse side beat Angers 2-0. One scored by him, another a penalty, which was won by him as well.
It's great to see Sanogo in a bit of form. I wrote a column about him not having scored a top-flight goal for 6 years, including his time at Arsenal, and having been a 17-year-old wonder kid, and next most likely, he's now a goal machine.
So if Berahino went to France, that would be the that'd be the way to solve it.
I mean, that would be nice, actually.
We can move on to Feedback Corner. Ben in India says Sean Dyche could be off to Germany, breaking news, with a news report that suggests supermarket shoppers in the western German city of Aachen have stepped out of their comfort zone to sample burgers made from buffalo worms. As we all know, Sean Dyche eats worms. It's something that was brought up on this podcast which we got from a Danish podcast, I believe, and then went viral. Worms are highly nutritious thanks to their high protein content and the larvae of buffalo beetles and are bred in the Netherlands.
Well, eating insects is the future, isn't it?
Mm.
They're incredibly high in protein and you can breed them in tiny spaces.
How many years to go until we have to just eat insects, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you eat in one of the many chicken shops of Forest Hill, you're probably fairly high on the insect ratio already.
Which manager would fare the best in a sort of post-apocalyptic wasteland? I gotta figure Sean Dyche would be high up there.
Of course, Sean Dyche. No one's going to beat Dyche, are they? Maybe. I reckon Michael Appleton will do all right, wouldn't he?
I could see Alan Pardew leading an alternative cultish society with himself as the figurehead.
The saviours.
Would he have made a giant sort of... Would you go in through a giant Alan Pardew cave with his mouth be the cave and his whole face?
It's a compound. You go into his compound.
And once you're in... never leave.
I can imagine this cult being brought down and smashed to pieces by a double team of Sean Dyche and Nigel Pearson, who would be ferocious in a number of ways.
Dale Oddley says, there's been lots of discussion in the media regarding Mourinho and Pep and whether United would have won the title this year if they'd had Pep as manager. My question is, what is the worst side in the Premier League that if you gave them Messi or Ronaldo would have a genuine chance of winning the league?
Leicester.
I like that.
I wouldn't go below Spurs. I think Spurs would win the league with Messi.
But Leicester, I think, have the tools to put together a fairly credible defensive unit. And if you just put like Messi and Vardy in front of that,
can Messi and Vardy work together?
It's a question. I think that would really work. I think the sort of quick little through balls from Messi onto Vardy, who's still got a turn of pace. I mean, I know you want a flippant answer, but I mean, that's a pretty good, serious answer.
Jordan says, which Premier League player would get the fastest marathon time? Would it be rated of distance covered this season? If so, you're looking at a 1-2-3 of Jack Cork, 133 kilometres, Abdoulaye Doucouré, 130 kilometres, and Pascal Gross, 129 kilometres.
But that's purely distance, isn't it? That's like extreme running.
That's the Marathon des Sables.
How quickly has Jack Cork run his extreme distances?
It's a very good question.
Got to figure N'Golo Kanté would be handy in a marathon.
I think he's more a 1500 metre runner.
You reckon?
Yes.
I reckon he could like turn his hand to anything running wise.
For me, no, he's run a lot, hasn't he? But yeah, again, maybe 800.
And finally, Kieran writes, I just wanted to say, listening to the pod got me through the London Marathon yesterday. It was tough and very hot. I wanted to say thanks, all the best. So in some way, we also did the marathon.
The London Marathon.
Yeah.
Well, it's the only way I will ever do it.
What's your beef with the marathon, Barney?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of love for them. It's a great thing. It raises loads of money. I have to say, if you've lived in London all your life, most people hate the marathon. It's really annoying.
Because of just the traffic.
The incredible disruption. But you know, marathon, great.
Would you ever do it?
No, I don't understand why you'd want to run 26 miles. Why? Human beings aren't designed to run that distance. The first guy who did it dropped dead on the spot, having delivered his message.
My father ran the New York Marathon. He actually did it after turning 50, if I'm not mistaken, which is quite a thing. And it's one of those things that, as a kid, my father's an accountant. As a child, I didn't think he was the most exciting man in the world. But I could understand that he'd run an impossible length of distance, which little Lars Heverson thought was quite good.
Well, I'm sorry it took that to bring you together.
I did it twice. You're right, Barney. It's bloody miserable. No one ever tells you how miserable it is. Everyone says it's the best day of your life. It's not.
Were you also upset about the congestion and traffic problems you could see around the race?
That was what really upset me as you were running. No. I mean, I've told this to Barry a million times, but I was overtaken by a cream bun on the mall. In my official photo, I'm being overtaken by what can only be described as Mr. Miyagi's great-great-granddad. It was just a pit of total misery. Never do it. And on that note, on that happy note, Barney, thanks for your time.
Thanks, bye.
Bye. Thanks, Lars.
It's good, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
And we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.